My name is Zoe, the co-host of Not Superwoman. I am the granddaughter of French, English and Irish immigrants now living on Burrurong land. I acknowledge that we meet on the land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, who are the traditional owners of the land in which this podcast was recorded. We pay respects to elders past and present. I recognise and respect their cultural heritage, beliefs and relationships with this land.
This is a trigger warning. In this week's episode of Not Superwoman, we discuss conversations around consent and sexual violence. If you are not in the space to listen to this episode, we do suggest you skip it. If you listen to this episode and you feel the need to seek help, there are support networks around sexual violence, sexual assault or domestic violence that you can call the 24-hour National Counselling Service 1-800-RESPECT. Welcome to this week's episode of Not Superwoman. Morning, Rat.
Morning. You ready for this ep, which I, I feel really reflective about my youth.
Oh, gosh.
Chatting to Chanel.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I said who we were chatting to. Oops.
No. Well, to fill you in, I'm sure you would have seen this amazing woman pop up on your social media or on the news or on your newspapers. Chanel Kontos. She is the founder of Teachers Consent, a website that was built back in 2020 that was all a part of Chanel's big push for consent and consent education to come to the forefront of policy, legislation, but also people's minds. And she recently released her book, Consent Laid Bare. And I tell you what, it doesn't matter who you are, whether or not you are someone in your younger years that is at uni or high school and you're dating or hooking up or whatever, it's a fascinating and reflective and powerful book that reminds us about the importance of understanding consent, consent education, and all that happens within the modern world now of navigating. Like it's just, but then also if you're a parent, I mean, it's weird. Zoe and I have been talking about how we listen to the audiobook of Chanel reading the book, and it is so confronting on for both sides. It reminds us of the teen angst of our youth and the situations that we ended up in.
There's just so many different facets of this conversation of talking about this book. Like, everybody should read it.
Yes. And then, you know, as parents now with children, and Zoe's got two girls, I've got a daughter and I've got two boys, and I feel really responsible now to make a shift or change in what has been socially acceptable in regards to just dismissing and minimising such an important integral issue. And we talked to Chanel about not only the fact of what she sort of raises in the book. I mean, if you wanted to sort of hear some confronting statistics, I mean, she talks about more than half of women in their 20s have experienced sexual violence. 97% of girls and women in Australia have experienced street harassment. 1 in 5 women in Australia have been raped, with only 5% reporting sexual assault and only 1.7% of sexual assault cases resulting in a conviction. And they're just some of the statistics that Chanel highlights in the book. And that is on the, I guess, the high level of why it's so important that we have these conversations. And also, I mean, on the seed of it, we talk about what is the seed for change and how do we change this for our kids.
And how empathy is so important. And you do, you know, I've been doing a lot of thinking about this, obviously, because we've been talking about it and working towards this episode. It's also understanding backgrounds people come from, the way that they've been taught, the way that they've been brought up. It's all about education and changing from the beginning and teaching them, you know, yes, about consent, about feelings, empathy, to have, you know, these better relationships and better understanding of you know, both sides of relationships.
Definitely. I mean, she talks about, you know, we need to remove the, you know, boys will be boys attitude, and we need to really push for empathy to be at the forefront for males particularly, and also teaching our kids that no means no, and starting that narrative really strongly so that the seed for change can occur, coupled with what Chanel's been able to achieve, which is legislation change and mandating consent education in school from kinder to year 10, creating consent education packages for educators, and you know, so much more. It just goes to show when one woman, who she does acknowledge that she has had incredible mentors, an incredible group of friends and a supportive family, yeah, that with all of that, what one person is able to achieve when they put their mind to something, and it went from putting up a post on Instagram to now being like a fully, you know, legislated, mandated policy changes, you know,
in all Australian schools.
Yeah, it's just, yeah, incredible. And I said to her, and I was fascinated to talk to her, because I was like, I want my daughter to have that confidence and that drive to speak up, and that drive to know her boundaries and you know, live by her values, and that's certainly what Chanel does.
I'm left in awe, and I absolutely loved chatting with Chanel.
So we can't wait to share our great chat with what is an incredible woman who is going to do so much more. Here is Chanel.
Welcome to this week's episode of Not Super Woman. We are so excited to be sitting down with the incredibly clever, courageous, and bit of a fangirl I am of Chanel Kontos. Welcome, Chanel.
Welcome, Chanel. We're thrilled.
Chanel, you have been, a powerhouse of late, especially over the last few years. But my goodness, you have just been racing around the country. We've watched on our screens and phones and social media of you doing so much incredible work for Teachers Consent, and also your book, Consent Laid Bare, which I have been listening to the audiobook, so I feel like I've been listening to you all the time. I think we bumped into each other at the Future Women's Summit, where I saw you get the Trailblazer Award, and so deserved. So congratulations.
Thank you. Thanks, I'm so sick of listening to my voice.
No, and I've been listening too, but I actually like listening to it in the car, because I stop and start, but then I get time to process it too.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, especially I think that's process is such a good word. I mean, the content of what you're putting to the forefront of our minds and the media is just so confronting, but so necessary and needed. And I think Zoe and I, being in our, you know, heading towards our middle-aged era, really hits home for us, because we're now been through that stage of our lives, so to speak, because we've now got, you know, in relationships and life partners, but we've also got children, boys
and daughters, boys and girls, yeah.
And so when we listen to your book, it's like we're hearing it from two angles now, and I know that I was so confronted, because I was like, that you're literally talking exactly how sort of my youth and teen years unfolded.
Yeah.
And Zoe and I just can't believe that it's now 2024.
And it's still happening that way. Like nothing's changed.
Well, changing.
Changing. Yeah. It is changing.
Yeah. I hope so, but in some aspects, I mean, I'm sure we'll get to this later, but in some ways it's probably getting worse as well, which is scary, isn't it?
I think, I mean, all we can do is champion what you had incredibly started, and I mean we will talk about it, but I mean it went from you talking to your girlfriends one night, and I think in your book you're explaining how you all kind of came to tell the tales of stuff that had happened to you with hookups and boyfriends and so on, and then you decided to put it to Instagram and do a poll. My biggest question to you is, where did you get the self-confidence to do that? I mean, it's Instagram would have been, you would have at the time had lots of friends and if not like family members and stuff, like where did it come to you to go, okay, this is what I'm going to do, I'm going to go put it out there? And then my second question to that is, how did you get the self-confidence and what do you attribute it to that you had the belief in yourself to put it out there?
So when my friends and I had those conversations in 2020 during COVID, I originally texted a few people that I knew had experienced sexual assault at school, like basically just my friends, and asked them to send me testimonies. So I had kind of done it behind the scenes, but taking it to social media, I felt like that's kind of where the confidence kicked in. And it was something that I didn't have at first when I first started thinking about it. And honestly, when I actually posted that initial Instagram poll, I was with two of my best friends at the time. And that moment was fueled by a lot of anger, a lot of injustice. There's lots of emotion there. And I was also living in London. I was on the other side of the world. And I think that really helped because it didn't feel as though I kind of had to, you know, I wouldn't go to the beach the next day and run into someone who I'm talking about or yep. someone who sent me something or whatever. It felt like I was just kind of like in a different world. It was still COVID. So there was still like, you know, lots of isolation and no one was going between UK and Australia anytime soon. So I think, yeah. And I also think the other reason I was so confident to do it was because I just never thought what it would become. I had no idea how big it would become. I think if I knew all of that, I think I would have been a lot more scared. But because I kind of thought that, you know, it would be some... My intention was to put all the testimonies together and then give them to the principals of schools that were mentioned, hoping that they would do something about their school, which seems a lot less scary than what ended up happening with lots of media and
it's public insane. It is seriously incredible the response that you've received.
Yeah.
Like it's outstanding. Because where did you get the strength to speak up about what, you know, something that's so deeply personal to you on, I guess, such a distressing topic?
Yeah, again, I think it just came from that anger and like feeling of needing to do something. And in terms of talking about my own story of sexual assault, so actually the first testimony I ever posted was my own story, but it was anonymized, so no one knew and it didn't matter and I didn't really think anything of it. But the first time a media, like a journalist, asked me if I had been sexually assaulted, I remember I was like really taken aback because I was like, well, I mean, obviously, but is that the point of this? Mm. And then I realized that, you know, if I'm asking people to share their testimonies and I have to be, and it wasn't even a thought process. It was just kind of like obviously, why else would I be investing all this time in this and be so passionate about it? I basically didn't get to think. Like, it happened so fast. I posted on Instagram on like, I think it was like the 17th of February or something, and was getting like a couple of, I don't know, like drips of responses to testimonies. And then by the 20th of February, I was getting hundreds in an hour and doing live TV media interviews. And like, I didn't even have a chance to think about it.
And so then that being said, I think about, it's funny because I look at you and what your courage and what you've been able to say and achieve. And I think for myself, having a daughter, I'm like, oh, I want my daughter to have that. Like, I want her to have the gumption to be like, you know, this is what I have to say and you're going to listen to me. Do you attribute that to the way in which you were raised, to your parents? Was it, you know, who sort of helped shape you in the strength to have that?
Oh, that's such a good question. Probably more my brothers than my parents, maybe. I don't know. I feel like, so they're 10 years older than me and we have really great open, I have a really great open relationship with them and kind of always have, because they're so much older, it's almost as if we never had that kind of like sibling fight things that happen.
Yeah.
They kind of raised me as well. But also my friends, like I really feel as though more than anyone or anything, my friends raised me, and I'm so lucky to have the most beautiful, amazing friends who are really inspiring and hardworking and kind, and we've always been like that from when we were young. But I think if I happened to be in a different sort of youth group or a different friend group, it could have gone a lot differently given the impact that they had on me.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it, how much like school and friendships and stuff like that can really change your trajectory on like who you surround yourself with. And but yeah. It sounds as well.
Well, your friends lift you up, like they, you know, they motivate you to do things, have these conversations, and I guess that's what led you to do this too.
Yeah.
Is the strength and the camaraderie.
If anything, actually, so my parents are Greek and they're pretty old school in their values. And if anything, I think their values that I strongly disagreed with growing up almost made me more inclined to like speak up about it, because I feel as though I got more of an overt look into a lot of these attitudes than like a lot of my peers.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, but I'm not saying they've learned a lot in recent years, and they've always encouraged me to be, you know, confident and strong and all of these sort of things, and very much like, you know, you can do anything you want to do. Except I think just from a cultural lens, it felt more obvious.
No, I hear you, and that makes sense. How has it been for your family? I mean, given that literally you're talking about 17th of February to the 20th and doing media interviews, I mean, how did your family and parents sort of manage and respond to what was happening?
There were teething pains. Overall, I mean, you probably saw them at Future Woman. They're all over it, taking photos, smiling.
Love your mum and dad.
Yeah, no, they're both retired now, and I have to explain that they can't just come to work with me every day.
I love that they want to, though.
And I'm like, it's really not professional. and it's really sweet.
That is so funny. So how did you understand the boundaries of, like, what you could ask and, I guess, topics that you were delving into, you know, with legal?
The boundaries of legal stuff.
Yeah.
So, interestingly, I had never heard of defamation or anything before I started this. I had no concept of kind of, like, what I legally could or couldn't say. Really luckily, for whatever reason. When I actually first collected testimonies, I got my friends to add in like what they did now to make a point of how little accountability there was and that these people are, you know, valued members of society. And a lot of the answers were things like, you know, they're a banker at this company, or they're a, you know, a lawyer at this company, or like whatever. I don't know why I ended up taking that out when I went public with it. Maybe because I was worried about, again, this idea of singling someone out. Even though I didn't know about defamation laws or understand anything about that, I instinctively knew that these testimonies had to be personal enough that people felt as though it was in their realm, which is why I named the schools and asked for people to send in the school year, because it, you know, narrows it down to 100, 200 people and really makes it feel closer to home than just like, you know, a testimony of anything. But there was also a part of me that knew if we tried to name individual people, people wouldn't get around the campaign because people don't like accountability. They don't like it when it's too close to home.
Mm.
And I also think that would have scapegoated people and made it seem as though they were the only option. They were the only issue, where actually, you know, this is a whole cultural wide issue. And even if you're not someone who has perpetrated sexual violence, I wanted them to be able to read these testimonies and understand how they were still responsible for this culture that meant that thousands of them happened at the same time. So it was basically, thank God, because legal issues would have been an actual disaster. And there were a few defamation cases that did slip through the cracks. You know, people named like a job description or a, you know, a football team or a...
Extra details.
Yeah, extra details that meant that people in their lives could pick it up. And there were a few threats of defamation against me. But in general, I knew that we had to toe this level of how can we make this close enough to home that people are willing to engage in it and feel as though they have to do something about it, but not so close that they reject it because it hurts too much to think about.
I mean, yeah. It's just wild to me on so many levels, but one particularly is that, I mean, we started with that you had the confidence to put something up, and then you had the sort of know how to find the boundaries of what was going to be enough for it to affect people and hit home. But then then further to that, I mean, once getting to the point of having hundreds and then into the thousands, I mean, how did you know how to take that information and shape it to utilise it as insights and then give it to evidence? Like, what was the stepping stone? Go, okay, well, now we've got all of these responses, and I know you mentioned it was the intention with school principals and educators and so on, but
like, how did you present it to them in order to make them, you know, make that change?
So this was all happening on my Instagram, and then one of my friends messaged me saying, you need a website. And he was like, give me the weekend. And basically by Monday morning, he had made what was now the first iteration of teachersconsent.com.
Oh, that's awesome.
I know. I'm so thankful to him for it. And his name's Jack Pascoe, and he also worked with another woman called Sophie Gardner to put it together, and I'm so thankful for them. And they honestly, they just like did this thing, and then we're just like, yeah, no, like they don't even, they honestly just did it completely selflessly, which was so lovely. And that is what took Teachers Consent to the next level. And that's how we named Teachers Consent. Like, he messaged me being like, what do you want the domain URL to be? And I was like, and just kind of like so sporadic, it just all happened. And then when we were writing down like what was going to be on the landing page, because at this point I was getting testimonies on my Instagram and posting them on Instagram, or I think I'd moved to a Google Doc or something really chaotic. I don't know.
I love an open Google Doc that everyone can edit.
I made it so they couldn't edit, but they could view, and there was like thousands of people on this Google Doc at one time. It was actually nuts. Anyway, and then it's really funny. And then we had this website, and he was like, hey, well, what do you want the opening thing to be? And at this point, testimonies were coming in from all over Australia, you know, not just private schools, public schools, Catholic sector, like everything. And I remember feeling a bit silly at the time when I said, like, let's do this. But I was like, well, may as well aim high. I mean, it was just like petition for consent education to be mandated in Australia, just like the whole thing. And that was like such a big jump from being like, oh, I'm going to collect these, I'm going to do some research on it, and I'm going to send it to the principals, to being like, actually, this is a, you know, Australia-wide issue. And that's when we also launched the petition alongside the testimony submissions. And yeah, almost 50,000 Australians signed that over the course of a year, most of them the first kind of few months.
Wow. 50,000. I mean, that's...
Aim high, my friend, aim high.
I know. Well, God, but also, like, super frightening.
Oh, it's terrifying.
That is the number that you can get to with starting with what was, you know, just a step-by-step for you and just going day to day managing how it was growing. My goodness.
But sometimes you just kind of go with it and these things just take off and you've got to ride it.
Yes, well, it's
you know, with ideas you have, sometimes if it comes to you, you just do it. And what's the worst thing that can happen?
I know, and I think with talking to you, it's just such a tale of modern day advocacy and activism, like the way in which you can start and create something and create such a powerful impact. Again, is like I'm fascinated not only for my own self, but for the sake of my, you know, my children, my sons and my daughters.
It creates, yes, so much conversation. I've been speaking to my husband about it. He's like, do we need to talk about this at 11 p.m. at night? I'm like, it's on my mind.
Yes, we do.
Anyway, it's, you know, how do you, I can never say this word, compartmentalise. Thank you. Can never say it.
The different, I didn't know what word you were getting
at. Yeah, and I was like, the different roles you play, because I guess, you know, how do you wind down when you're always on the go? Like, do you, you know.
Zoe, it's cute that you think I do.
Well, I'm like, can you please? I feel like you need it for your mental health.
That, yes, yeah. Or is this just like give it everything you've got and for as long as you can and figure out the next step as you've been going?
Yeah, no, I'm being dramatic. I have had breaks. I definitely have. I had, you know, over Christmas this year was pretty sustained. That was probably the longest break I've had in ages, just because it felt like everything was under control for the first time in ages and everyone just went on leave and I was like, great. But I've also kind of taken forced breaks before. The weird thing is I do so much traveling because I work remotely. So I'm like often in like the most beautiful places, like objectively relaxing places in the world, but I just like keep doing the work, which is so fun and I love. But I've had a few times where I like have fully burnt out. It was actually So the first time, so it all started in February, and then the first time I took a proper holiday that year was in October. And I was doing full-time masters and working basically full-time, if not more. I was like, my sleep schedule was whack because I was working Australian hours and it was just not good. And I literally used to eat baby food because I couldn't be bothered to cook, which is so embarrassing.
Actually a really, really good idea.
Yeah, I mean, really. Yeah, I mean, yeah, actually quite smart. Probably getting enough nutrients, but not ideal.
Yeah. I mean, more than one serving. And anyway, I went to Mauritius, and the first week I got there and like actually stopped and relaxed, I got eczema everywhere. I got this crazy like body rash. I got like so unwell, like my adrenaline ran out, and my actual, how my body was actually feeling, like all came out at once. I literally looked like a different person, like 1 week before and 1 week after, because like I was just like inflamed and eczema-y. I'm sorry, I'm being really gross right now.
No, but it's what happens. Gross.
Yeah, it was gross.
And, it's like, your body telling you, like, I'm at my peak.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I slept like 14 hours a night for like a week or something nuts. And then afterwards I just like came back and was like, oh, I'm okay now. And I've realized now that I need to like take those breaks before that sort of thing happens. And I do now. And it is like actually completely fine now.
Yeah. It's just figuring out, like, because what you're dealing with, I mean, on a day-to-day basis, I mean, Zoe and I talked about, but you've been listening to and talk a lot about sexual assault stories. And so, I mean, I just wonder about how do you compartmentalize that and keep, I mean, I often think about a story where a woman was a counselor, and she tells me about how she would listen to people, and then to get home to be able to manage, she would have a shower and watch the water wash off her so that she could feel like she was washing away the sort of energy or the stress, and she could start, you know, move forward after the shower type thing. So my point is, how do you manage talking about stuff that is so emotionally confronting and then keep, you know, compartmentalized so that you as Chanel alone away from teacher's consent?
Yeah, I think that's actually probably more where I struggle, rather than actually taking time off work. It's just like, okay, well, when you're not working, how do you not think these things? Because it's impossible, right? Like, I can't, like, I don't go a day without hearing a story of sexual assault or rape, or like, whether that's at work, whether it's someone I see in the street who, you know, feels comfortable to share that with me, which is really lovely. But at first it was really bad. So I had never heard of vicarious trauma, which is basically when you experience, it feels as though you've experienced the things that someone's like told you in detail, or that you've read or heard or whatever. And I basically read 7,000 stories of sexual assault in a few weeks with no previous training of like how to like handle that or what to do. And it's interesting you say the shower thing, because I did have a lot of showers in 2021. I found showers really healing and cleansing, and kind of like a way to be like, okay, kind of end the day with like, you know, a scorching hot shower to kind of just be like, that's it. We're done. But it is something that I think more than anything, and I say this in my book, it's kind of like the closing chapter about a bit of a reflection on all the work and stuff like that. I don't think I would change anything, because I'm so happy with all of the policy changes and legislation changes and the conversations and all of that stuff. But working in this space, and especially those first few months of 2021, I think have changed me forever in terms of like my relationship with sex and men and even myself. And I think that's something that I'm going to have to spend a really long time to work through, or like completely, maybe, I don't know. I don't know how to, like, I don't know how I could ever get rid of that while still working in the industry.
Yes. I mean, it's something that I can imagine would have an impact. And you mentioned earlier training. Is there, like, have you been able to work with teams or people that have helped you train to compartmentalize, or help you train how to listen to a story and not absorb it? Or no, it is, it's just par for the course, because it is your driving force in teacher's consent?
Yeah, I think it's hard. I think the kind of damage was a bit done already, and just in terms of like mass distrust of mainly men. But what's actually really interesting, and I was thinking it this morning when I was on a walk, I've become so much less empathetic than I used to be. I used to really think of myself as an empathetic person. I used to really feel as though I felt a lot of the emotions that people would share with me. And I've had to learn to switch that off so that when someone tells me a story about a rape, I don't take that on anymore. And sometimes it makes me feel like I'm being a bad person, but then I'm also like, well, I just can't do this work unless I do that. Because if I actually gave every single story the empathy it deserved, it would absolutely
Eat you up.
me. Yeah. And it's something that I hear a lot from people who work in the NGO or charity sphere, or like anything to do with kind of like, any stories, maybe not just violence, but also stories of poverty or like human trafficking or like all these different things. You just have to put up this wall. And it is kind of weird. Like, I could literally, especially if I'm with other friends who work in the sector, if it's like child sexual abuse prevention or domestic violence prevention, whatever, we almost make joke. I say that badly. It doesn't come across as badly. We're not making jokes about
I
this.
understand what you mean. Yeah.
Joking about like the. Joking about, how we're feeling about it or like whatever. And it's like we're actually laughing about these things
Well, it's a
because,
coping mechanism. Yes, it's
yeah.
like you've built, because you're working in legislation and policy and advocacy, I can imagine it's a way in which you not only a coping mechanism on a day-to-day, but it's also like you have to turn the material that's presented to you into insights and information, and to further strategize and push forward what you're trying to advocate for. And so I can understand that it's a, yeah, exactly what that a coping mechanism.
And I also think, I feel like, I don't know if you can relate, but I feel like a lot of women can relate. Even sometimes I've had this even before I worked in the space where with other women, we joke about how messed up the things we experience are, whether that's been like, oh my God, my period was so bad that I fainted and threw up at work. Or like
Totally.
talking about, sexual assaults or like the way men treated us or like a way that a group of men were interacting with us on a night out or something like that. Like whatever it is, I think it is a defense mechanism, not just of people who work in the industry, but of women in general to laugh about these things.
Oh, so true. I mean, even the fact that we were reading and listening to Consent Laid Bare and reflecting on our history and well, not childhood, but teens and 20s and stuff.
Teen angst
And yeah,
years.
the teen angst years, and we were laughing about it. But then
But then
what
we're
was.
like, this is so wrong.
Yeah, it
But
was.
it is that, we're all sharing stories, we're all talking about things, and we're like, these things are just so wrong.
But it is, it feels a bit of like a despair management in that you sort of like, I don't know what else I could do but laugh. And I was sort of trying to talk to my husband about it and in the lead up to doing this interview. And it was the first time that I was starting to feel this well of like, it's funny how you can laugh about it with your girlfriends, but you can't, like it
No.
just was a
My God,
completely different
no.
experience when
Yeah,
I was sharing it with a male.
it's
I
just
was
the
like,
men cannot laugh. They're not allowed
no, so many
no.
different feelings of like.
No, but the feeling inside me,
Yeah.
he was listening, but the feelings inside me went from laughing about it with my girlfriends to then when I was sharing it with a male, it was just this overwhelm of, actually, I don't know how I feel about sharing this. I don't think you're going to understand. I'm not going to be able to laugh about it with you.
Yeah.
This uncomfortable, very uncomfortable feeling of it all. Anyway,
I'm
sorry.
feeling
No,
that
it's
off
so
you
true.
right
It's
now. I'm like, I'm uncomfortable.
I know. I was starting to get emotional as I was talking about it.
Yeah, but
Sorry.
I don't know. Like like how could you not feel
Yes.
emotional? And I think that's why it is one I'm really enjoying. Well, even though it's obviously heavy, but yeah, listening to your audiobook. Because it does promote these conversations.
Yes. Well, thank goodness it's coming to the forefront, and especially in our generations, like and above. It's like it's just it. Prior to seeing Teachers Consent and Chanel, you do your interviews, it literally for me has never been talked about, and so it is incredibly refreshing to see a shift. And I mean, what you've managed to be able to do in the last 3 years, 4 years is just insane.
Thank
It's, I mean, a huge credit to you. I realise it also comes at a giant cost, and really what you're doing is such an enormous public service for women all around the world, really. So, I mean, I but it's funny, as a mum, I sort of, the questions when I was writing them and talking to Zoe about it was sort of very aware of your age. And I was like, this is a lot for a woman of your age, and you're incredibly intelligent and eloquent, and you manage it so well. But it leads us to, I mean, one of our questions, which is, how do you, you know, how do you feel about all these people of different ages and positions of power coming to you and seeking your guidance almost?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's weird because I have like reverse imposter syndrome. I actually hate that phrase because it only ever gets used to describe women. But when I'm in a room with, like, I remember really clearly once being in a room with three ministers and the sex discrimination commissioner. And so two commissioners and three ministers, and we're in a meeting in Parliament House. And someone, like, before or after was like, are you nervous? And I was like, no, not at all. Like, why would I be nervous? And I feel, like, really comfortable in these, like, places where I feel like as a young woman I've infiltrated there because I think young women deserve to be there. And I feel like that young voice adds benefit and is really refreshing. But then when I speak to my peers, that's where I feel like I'm like, oh my God, am I meant to be a spokespiece for this? Because we've all had such different experiences, and you know, we've all lived through it. And like, you already know all the things I'm saying, basically. So yeah. And I mean, sometimes it can be a lot of pressure, but I also think I mitigate that by, sexual violence is one of the biggest issues facing the world, basically. It's in all corners of the globe. Mm. You know, one in three women worldwide will experience sexual violence, which is just like devastating. And if we're talking about things like sexual harassment, barely anyone's spared. And I've really narrowed down into like teen on teen perpetrated mainly out of entitlement. I know I work with and talk to the whole of Australia, but a lot of the time when I speak from experience, I'm also talking a lot about these kind of like private school scene that I grew up in and where I think rates of sexual violence are slightly higher. And I just feel really comfortable staying like in my lane there because I'm like, I know this so well. Whereas I would try to never speak on behalf of like other groups that, you know, maybe it's intersecting with a different class or race where the types of sexual violence and the reason for that have like so many other layers and dimensions. I try to just like elevate those voices, but never be a spokesperson for them.
It's, I guess, yeah, you're staying, as you said, staying in your lane of what you know, you feel comfortable.
Have you had, another question that comes to mind, have you had anyone mentor you through this, or have you sought guidance with anyone?
Yeah, so many people, honestly, so many amazing people. I couldn't even think about them and name them all, but the Teachers Concerned has like an advisor panel, and they help a lot with the direction of the company, but then also just personally, it's actually incredible how many people have like offered to help, or how many women I've met, and also some men who are older than me and willing to give me advice about things. I really feel like any issue I've ever had, I've been able to pick up the phone and get the opinion from like four different people who I really trust and who are really willing to invest in time.
Which is fantastic. Because do you think, you know, doing, like obviously on the release of the book, it's changed the relationship you have with men in your life?
I think doing the petition changed the relationship I had with men in my life, less so the book. I lost heaps of male friends. It was really weird and hard and sad, but that's okay.
Mm.
I mean, I was also living in London and you drift from people. And obviously it was during COVID. So again, a lot of people drifted and relationships shifted and people kind of gravitated towards those that they were closest with and got in their groups of 6 or 15 or whatever. But but then it's also really strengthened a lot of the male relationships I have in my life, which I'm really thankful for.
Yeah.
And, you know, opened the door for a lot of conversations with friends of mine who are good guys, but never really thought much about this. whereas now they're kind of like actively anti-misogynistic or like anti-sexist rather than just kind of being like, yeah, I'm a good guy, but whatever.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, so true. I mean, it makes me think about the fact that as we – from my experience of getting older, quality over quantity, in that the people in your life that make you feel safe, seen and heard are the people that sort of stay. And I think it's a great way to look at it in regards to the fact that you've managed to open up the eyes of so many people and, you know, males in your life that have seen what you're sharing and showing and teaching in new light. So it's, I mean, you're not alone in that friendships, they sort of, you know.
Well, they change.
They do. They change as you change.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, which is a hard reality of becoming an adult, but it's true.
Yes.
I only have one friend left and that's you.
We've been friends since year seven, so.
We've been through it all, thick and thin.
Maybe I can't infiltrate that group, but maybe we can do dinner or something one day.
And so, I mean, you know, that being said, you talk about in your book the fact that you have at times received like ridiculous sort of written abuse and stuff in DMs that you've been receiving. How do you just ignore that now, or is that just white noise and par for the course of teacher's consent?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. It's sometimes if I post something that just ends up on the wrong side of the algorithm, there could just be like hundreds of really aggressive misogynistic comments. But most of the time, I mean, the feedback is still overwhelmingly good. And I know that it should bother me. And I know that harassment online is very serious and should be taken very seriously, but I don't know why. It's just something that's never really fazed me.
Yeah.
And also, like, again, when one of my videos or posts or something ends up on the wrong side of the algorithm and people are, you know, really dismissing what I'm saying or saying, you know, who gave women the right to vote or like, whatever they say, it just really proves the point.
Yes.
And I'm like, well, even if they commented that, at least it ended up there. Maybe it's some food for thought.
It's such a reflection of exactly what the message that teachers' consent is trying to get across, which is the irony in it is, you know, insane. But I think that it is all a part of your armour too. I mean, you mentioned earlier about the wall that comes up when listening to stories, and I think that that's obviously, I mean, part of your armour that's being built in regards to just being able to wash it off, so to speak, and, you know, see it in a light that views it as a reflection on them and part of the problem, really.
Yeah. It's also funny what comments do get to me, like I said, people can say like really horrible, like death threats, rape threats, like really misogynistic things. And it just goes straight over my head. And then I always like every couple of weeks, I check my Goodreads reviews to see what people are saying about consent laid bare. And most of them are really like lovely, you know, 4 or 5 star reviews. And then there was like this one that was like 1 star or something, being like, couldn't listen to the audiobook. Her voice was too annoying. I thought about it for like 3 weeks.
Knife, stab, twist.
Yeah, I was like,
you can't make everyone happy.
No. I mean,
it's almost as if the more mundane it is, the more it feels real.
Yeah, the more
it's like, oh, you actually say that. Whereas if they're saying some outlandish thing, you're like, I just don't agree with you. And I, you know, I can't. I'm not even taking this seriously.
Yes.
And I just think everyone's a lunatic. I'm always like, nah, they're a lunatic.
That's the way we get through day to day. We just tell each other that, yeah, oh, don't worry, they're
I'm
a lunatic.
I'm always like, they're not a hunji. They're not a hunji.
I did see a meme the other day about how best friends have a tendency to do that, where they just, instead of being accountable for us maybe being lunatics, we just say that everyone else is.
Yeah, but they are.
So in the audiobook that I was listening to, which I think your voice is lovely and I could listen to.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, I didn't have a problem with it. It was great.
But you do you mentioned and highlight sort of the definition of fawning, which I understand to be, it's essentially in very simple terms, it's almost like a people pleasing. in that you yeah. are in a circumstance or a scenario in which you just accept and you know, almost there's this misconstrued level of acceptance and responsibility because you're just trying to get out of the situation or to make sure that you can get to safety or exit the scenario, which Zoe and I reflected and we both were like, God, the amount of times we've done that throughout our lives and not even in necessarily sexual circumstances alone. It can be
– well, workplace, yeah. jobs, anyone that's got power over you that you –
you just sort of yeah. – there is this this overarching theme where unfortunately we are raised in – and we particularly are in a generation that did people please and fawn, you know, do fawning to get out of things. So my – when I was listening and reading about it, I was wondering about, do you think the seed for change in that is teaching children – empathy and, you know, getting boys, teaching boys about accepting rejection. I mean, how, what do you connect to the very seed for change?
So just to also elaborate a little bit more on the definition of fawning, mm-hmm. to reiterate, fawning is a survival response where you're over nice in order to survive an ordeal, which is all the things you just said, but just highlighting that it kicks in when your survival instincts kick in. I think that interesting what you're saying about like workplaces and all of that sort of stuff. I kind of think that women are in a constant state of fawning because I think we're like constantly trying to please the people around us in an attempt to keep us safe in like some lower end of the spectrum. But on the highest end of the spectrum, just for context, in a testimony, it would sound something like, he locked the door behind me, so I gave him head so that he wouldn't, you know, force me to have sex with him or whatever. Or I realized I was really drunk and my phone was out of battery and I was in a suburb I didn't know in the park with this guy. And you just, this kind of, you feel as though the only way to get out is to go along with the perpetrator. And yeah, I think it comes down to empathy because the thing with fawning that is so difficult and why our kind of criminal system will never be able to handle it is because I think fawning can be really easily misconstrued as consent. If the person yes. that you're in a sexual situation with is not centering your actual experience or pleasure, or, you know, if they don't think of you as an equal human to them, they can so easily allow their sexual entitlement to outweigh that empathy that they feel towards you. And sexual assault can occur with both the victim and the perpetrator being, well, maybe the perpetrator being oblivious and the victim being really confused about their own behavior. And fawning also leads to really high levels of self-doubt in victim survivors of sexual assault because they kind of regret not acting in a different way. But again, it's this idea that if your survival instincts have kicked in, you don't really get to choose how to act. Everyone's had a thing where in a split second, their body's done something. You know, you can be driving a car and someone pulls out and you either brake or accelerate and you didn't even think about it. You just like did one of them. That kind of split second reaction. And yeah, I think at the foundation of this, it's an empathy gap, the way that we socialize boys and girls. I think we socialize girls to be too empathetic and too accommodating and too people-pleasy and tell them that they shouldn't make a fuss and they shouldn't stand up for themselves and blah, 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 blah. And at the same time, we kind of like actively try to knock empathy out of our young boys. And we also, you know, tell them that you know, they're allowed to be boisterous and they're allowed to, you know, boys will be boys, they can cause trouble and havoc and like people will pick up the pieces around them and it'll be fine. And I think as parents, one of the biggest things that you can do to stop rape culture, not just to protect your own kids, but for everyone, if everyone kind of looked at it as like thinking of all children as everyone's children, is to raise the next generation of boys to be empathetic and, you know, respectful, because it's not just about teaching girls how to say no, which is a big part of it, because we don't really teach girls how to say no. But teaching boys how to accept a no, because it's only like a yes only counts if no is safe to say. And I think that's where people get really confused.
God, that's good.
Yeah, a yes only counts if a no is safe to say. That is such a good way to put it. And such a
and a lot of the times it's not safe to say no. I mean, as you said, even in the workplace we fawn, we like or, you know, even, I don't know, so
well,
many
there's so many
times.
Scenarios are running through my head. Like, this is totally different, but, you know, as a mother with children, family commitments, people putting pressure on you from every angle, it's, you do. Like, you just
feel obliged.
Yeah,
to satisfy every role that we play throughout our lives, and it can be in the space, in sexual space, but it can also be in the space of all the other facets
work,
of being a woman.
Friends, family, yeah.
And I think the thing there is, obviously, it's more important, or, you know, it's more serious when it happens in the sexual sense, because, you know, if you get kind of like coerced into agreeing to head to the parent night at your school to be a good mom, it's like, oh, for fuck's sake, but it's fine. Like, you know,
yes,
very different to being coerced into a sexual encounter.
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of why it's like this, like, spectrum of this behavior is quite socialized in us. It's also a very gendered trauma response, or biological sex trauma response, because fighting and flighting are not smart responses if we're talking about a stereotypical heterosexual situation and the man is stronger and bigger than you. Then why would you try to fight him or flight or run away from him if he's going to be able to outrun you or outfight you? So women are much more likely to freeze or fawn, which is very poorly understood, because up until the kind of like 90s, 2000s, almost all research on human stress responses were done on men and only males. And then they were like, oh, I wonder if like women respond differently. And we do, because fawning was actually initially called tend and befriend in literature, because it was the idea that if we're thinking like, you know, thousands of years ago, the woman would have to continue to tend to her offspring while befriending the threat,
right,
which was usually a man. And if you think about a woman in a domestic or sexual violence situation now with a child, it's kind of like they're still tending and befriending. It's like, well, how can I keep my child safe and me safe? It's, you know, means being nice to this perpetrator.
So we talk about the fact that it's empathy and it's boys accepting no and teaching our children. I've seen you speak at a press event where you were asked about the socialisation of co-ed versus single-sex schools, and you responding saying you're feeling conflicted about it. Do you think that throughout the work that you're doing and the research that you've done, do you feel more towards one way than the other, or do you, because I wonder about the socialization of spending those hours 5 days a week around both genders, and so making boys more empathetic and girls less intimidated. I wonder about the impact that that has, but I also know that when you spoke, you mentioned that, you know, for a girl to be around a perpetrator that might have been in an assault, to have to sit in a class next to them or have them sitting behind you or so on would be a horrific experience too. I just wondered if your stance had changed.
Yeah, no, it hasn't changed. I mean, I'm still conflicted in a certain sense. There's just so many like different moving parts, and there's like the theory behind it and then the reality. And the reality is that every child is different, and that some children may thrive in single-sex environments and some children may thrive in co-ed environments. And it's really up to the parents to kind of figure that out, both with them and thinking about it. And I think single sex spaces for women are really important, and I think that they need to remain, especially in schools, because a lot of young women do have trauma from male perpetrators. And I went to an all-girls school, and it was like the biggest privilege ever to learn kind of like away from the male gaze with like just the girlies. And like, again, I was going to say this before, my school was such a big factor in raising us to be like feminist women, because we were kind of under this like illusion of equality. And then we all got to university.
And then you got to
like,
real life.
Yeah. We were like,
then you got to uni.
Yeah, we got to uni and that wasn't fun. But it's really hard. I did my thesis on basically the culture in single-sex schools in Sydney. So I am really interested by the culture at a lot of these boys schools that are also really elite institutions. Bottom line is, I actually, and again, this is like super theoretical and it's never going to actually happen, I don't think private education should exist. I think all children should have equal access and opportunity, and that all the funding should go into making education better for everyone. But we do have a very like stratified school system in Australia, and it is interesting because it does really, really, really shape the next generation. And I think it's more so, it's not, because I know the video you're talking about, I got asked, like, do you want to see the end of all boys schools? And like, no, I don't want to see the end of all boys schools, but I would love to see all boys schools become prime spots where healthy masculinity is, gender equality and respectful relationships education are taught, seeing it as like a leverage point where it's like, oh, here is this like concentrated group of young men who are disproportionately going to go on to represent our businesses and our countries. Why don't we really heavily invest in making sure that they are as empathetic as possible towards women and other marginalized groups that they don't interact with day to day? And then I wouldn't have any problem at all with boys' schools. I think the problem is that they just tend to not do that.
Well, it sounds like with the work that you're doing, and especially, I mean, I understand that you've been creating consent education material with the not-for-profit Our Work, and you know, the legislation of mandatory consent education from kinder to year 10, it's safe to say you are putting everyone in the right direction. So our question, last question would be, is where to from here for you? You've done an incredible book.
Just a light question to finish up on.
I mean, I would love to work more broadly in gender equality and like take a step back and look at the kind of root causes of a lot of this. I'm really interested in parental leave and like men's involvement in that for improving equality. That was really successful in the Scandi countries. I really want to organize like a national walkout, honestly. Like, I think this year we just need to be like, we're done, here are our demands, like fix gender equality. I think there's no reason that Australia cannot be a leading gender equality country in the world. Like, there's just no reason. If our politicians decided they wanted to do it, they could do it like almost immediately. So I think it's just like keeping gender equality in the mainstream, because of course there's always going to be this like two-way relationship between reducing sexual violence is going to improve equality, and then the more we improve equality, the more reduction there'll be in sexual violence. So I don't know, but yeah, also we've got heaps to do with teachers' consent this year, which I'm so excited for. I'm going to keep trying to get the book into as many young people or parents or teachers and whatever hands, hopefully try to get that published overseas, and yeah, just see what happens.
Well, my goodness, if I could have your tenacity and energy levels, even by
she's like young
inch, I would. But I tell you what, we're with you, we champion everything that you're saying, and we just congratulate you on everything that you've achieved to date, but also everything that you've got on your agenda to come. We have no doubt that you will dominate, and we just want you, as Chanel Contos, to take care of yourself and make sure that there is time for you in all of this, because without your strength and energy, this episode and your book and everything that you do wouldn't be happening. So just make sure you take care of
Thank
yourself.
Thank you for that mothering.
I do.
Thank you. That was very sweet. Chanel, I appreciate it. I promise I'm looking after myself better now than I was before.
Good.
But thank you, Beck and Zoe, so much. It's so
it's
great
lovely
to
see you, and we can't wait to see much more to come.
Yay!
Thank you for joining us for this week's episode of Not Super Woman. You can find extra resources, links and information on our website, which is notsuper-woman.com.
Is that a dash or a hyphen?
A dash is a hyphen, Rash.
Wonderful.
And if you're enjoying what we're bringing, you can follow us on our socials, and we're across all podcast platforms. So hit subscribe, guys.